Hello and welcome to In Lockdown With, a podcast where I, playwright Kieran Fitzgerald, chat to emerging, established and experienced artists in the fields of theatre, film, television, dance and drama, from Wales and beyond, to find out more about their careers and to see how they've been coping during the coronavirus pandemic. Expect laughs, gossip, and an insight into the careers of some of Wales's best known creatives. If you enjoy this podcast, please like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thank you. Hello and welcome to this episode of the In Lockdown With podcast with me, Kieran Fitzgerald. Today my guest is the writer Amy Bethan Evans. Hi Amy, how's it going?
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for doing this.
It's alright.
How have the last kind of 2 years been for you?
I mean, like, when you say how are you, the response is normally has to be fine, thanks, doesn't it? But I feel like as this is a disabled-led podcast, I probably should say that I'm having a bit of a bad mental health week, because I think, you know, that is something that is okay to mention.
I think it's something, like you say, it's an automatic answer. Mm. Like, I'm fine. But, yeah, I think we need, you know, it's difficult. Especially in our industry, when Alice Eklund was on last week and she was talking about...
I just feel like if you don't really care about the answer, don't say how are you, just say hope you're well.
Exactly.
It's the same message.
It's filler, isn't it? Yes, so I think we do that a lot. So how are you feeling kind of confidence-wise in terms of theatre reopening and...
Back a few times. I got, you know, other people are more cautious and haven't been back yet, and you know there are other people that are like acting like there was never a pandemic. I have been to the theatre a few times. I find fringy work a bit safer, like the people there seem to wear their masks more and adhere to the guidelines and know how temperamental it is that we're open at all. Whereas I have been to a couple of West End shows where nobody's wearing a mask. So, you know, I feel a bit more nervous in those kinds of environments. I mean, while I'm in London, like, you know, obviously I want to be cautious, but I'm not going to, you know, if I get COVID myself, I'm triple vaxxed.
Yeah.
Whereas if I'm in Bristol and I get COVID myself, I might be triple vaxxed, but I also live with my elderly parents. So, you know, it's, you know, so I think in London I've been a little bit braver. Like when I go back to Bristol to visit my parents, I do go out a little bit less.
It's about kind of managing that risk, I guess. But the first thing I wanted to ask you, which is how I kind of start all these podcasts, is... how did you first get interested in theatre?
Well, I used to go a lot as a kid. My parents love cats, and Cats started in Bristol, so we would go and see that whenever it was in town. And because I'm visually impaired, my sibling and I are both visually impaired, we would always get cheaper tickets at the front. So, it was lots of good opportunities to see musicals and things. And when my dad put the songs from Oklahoma and Carousel onto a tape, we listened, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, that's a favourite of his. We would sing along to those in the car, and I realised that I could mimic operatic voices quite well. And my mum said, oh, you've got a lovely voice. And I auditioned for a choir and I got in. And I trained my voice from about the age of 10.
Was it singing first for you?
It was singing first. I always liked making up stories. And you know, I think I'm neurodivergent, and I didn't realize this was part of neurodivergence, but something I used to do a lot as a kid was run around fiddling with something like a keychain to stimulate my brain, where I would make up stories
Right.
and tell them to myself, and like, I would just go out in the garden and do it, or like, you know, I'd do it around the house. And I don't know, I mean, my family managed to ignore it and not let it disturb them in any way. So, you know, it was just, I did always make up stories, and I did always enjoy creative writing at school. My primary school never had drama, and as
Right.
soon as I went to secondary school and there was drama, I was like, this is amazing. You know, I loved it. The teacher was incredibly strict. He had like military discipline. He's a legend. Hello, Mr. Alcock, if you're listening. But then the first lesson, he like got silence in the class, which no other teacher had managed to do that week. And I answered one of his questions correctly, and he gave me a praise point. But even that, he gave in a really scary way. Do you want a praise point? I was like, yeah. But like, yeah, I was really into it. But then,
When did you kind of think, oh, this is what I want to do?
well, I always wanted to be a teacher when I was a kid because my parents are teachers.
Right.
I always thought that that was what I'd do. And I think, you know, I would enjoy the teaching aspect itself. But as I was a, but when I got a bit older, I would see just how much work my parents would be bringing home, and like, they wouldn't
Yeah.
stop working until 10 o'clock at night, and they were like constantly on call for their jobs. And you know, it just wasn't really an environment I wanted to go into. But I still, you know, I wanted to nurture my creativity. And also, like, because I'm visually impaired, like, I was never really raised to believe it was going to be a barrier. Like, I went to mainstream comprehensive, all of those things. But I started to realize that whatever I did was going to be hard, so I may as well do something I really wanted to do. And I'm also, I got very into, when I was about 13, I watched Hollyoaks rapidly, avidly. I would watch it in the week and then the omnibus. Like, you know, it was a routine for
Right.
me. And yeah, and there was a male rape storyline that really drew me in, because my mum wouldn't let me watch the late night episode, and quite rightly, it was horrifically violent. I say, having watched it about 2 weeks ago on YouTube, just to satisfy my curiosity. Maybe I would have handled it better when I was 13, I don't know. But but the story plotting, I think, in the storyline was excellent. Like, the way it dealt with the issues, the way, you know, the. And you know, the way it was marketed at teenagers that might be conceived, not necessarily things as bad as that, but might be bottling things up that they don't want to talk about, like bullying or whatever. And you know, and I just thought, I want to do that.
I'm not in a way that talks down to teenagers
Yes.
either, or meeting them at their level. Oh.
Yeah, like, these are characters a few years older than me, and you know, I was watching them thinking, yeah, that's the problems that they're having, and actually, you know, that's a valid thing to be talking about. And actually, because all my friends were watching it too, it was also a valid thing for us to be talking
Yeah.
about. And then a couple of years after that, there was the storyline on EastEnders with the Who Shot Phil Mitchell storyline, which was on the next year. I got very into that, just because, like, spoiler, if you haven't seen it 20 years ago, it was Lisa that shot him. But like, he treated her really badly before that, and I kind of really empathized with what she was feeling. And you know, I realized that I could get that, you know, how I could get empathy for these fictitious characters, and learn things about myself and process emotions in that way.
And were you kind of writing a lot as a child?
I enjoyed creative writing, and like, in class, I would be always writing much more than anybody else, and my teacher would be like, look at the length of it. But yeah, I think, you know, I can't remember if I did a lot in my spare time. I made up a lot of stories in my spare time. I don't think I did a lot of writing necessarily. I liked to make things up. I can't remember if I started writing things. I wrote a lot of poems, but I think I didn't really have the concentration span to commit to writing a story if I wasn't under school conditions.
Mm. And moving on a little bit to kind of university. So you studied an MA, but where
did you... I did a BA before that.
Where did you study your BA?
UWE in Bristol. So it's University of the West of England, so the one that isn't Bristol Uni.
My brother went there. He did computing there. So what...
Well, the drama department there is amazing.
What was your experience there like?
It was so much fun, and yeah, I didn't really have much choice about what university to go to because I grew up in Bristol. I was not ready to leave home when I was 18. I didn't get an interview for Bristol. That was even without looking at my predicted grades, which they're not allowed to do anymore. I knew I was going to go to UWE because it was the only choice. Really, it had a great drama department, and it was commutable distance from my parents' house. And what was really nice was being able to go somewhere in my own city and have loads of other people come and appreciate my city, and it shed new light on it for me, really. And you know, I made loads of friends, the friends that I still have now, and you know, I think it has a real community feel to it, and it's very hands-on, so it teaches you how to produce and to do things yourself, and that people aren't going to knock on your door and do it for you.
Yeah.
So you know, I would thoroughly recommend it to anyone that's thinking of doing a drama degree, even though like degrees are now expensive, and they weren't when I went to uni because I'm 35.
And were you thinking of yourself as a playwright? I want to be a playwright. Or...
I wanted to be an actor when I first went to uni. And I think like, you know, they knew I was visually impaired, like everybody knew that. I was also diagnosed with dyspraxia when I was 12, and I knew that was about coordination. I didn't really understand the mental aspect of it, like how it's about organization and all of forgetfulness and all of those things. So, you know, I was kind of semi-independent because I was still living with my parents, but it was also the other side of the city. So if I forgot something, I couldn't just ring my mum and say, can you drop it in?
Yeah.
You know, I did lots of trips to Woolworths to replace things that I couldn't find. That was, I'm really telling my age now, even though I've just told it. I wanted to be an actor. I did an acting module, which was a great experience. But like I was a member of the Bristol Old Vic Young Company at the time. It was a nice place to be, but it was very physical theatre orientated, and I couldn't do a lot of it. And I saw my friends at uni having a really good time in the drama society, so I decided I was going to do some more of that. And I made loads of great friends, and I had a really great time. But I never really got roles. And I, you know, and I think a lot of female students do go through that because plays have got more male characters in them. That is just the nature of plays at the moment. And, you know, we're taking steps to rectify that. And I think, you know, it is a responsibility if you have more female or female presenting students, they significantly outnumber male students, then you should do a play with more roles for them, or cast them in male roles. Like, you know, maybe do that. And you know, it's the same in a lot of amateur scenes as well, isn't it? Like, you know, if you're a man, you have a lot easier time getting a part, whereas all these professionally trained women are falling over each other. I had that, and also I did find auditioning difficult, which I didn't realise, but like I've got no spatial awareness, and I didn't realise, you know, how much that came across in auditions, and you know how much I would have to like hold scripts up to my face, and that would interfere with my audition technique. But like, you know, if I had a script and I had time to practice, I was great, but you know, there was that part of the audition process that was a barrier. And like soon it was summer and there was a show going to Edinburgh, and they said I didn't get a role, but they said I could come and be front of house manager, which, you know, I kind of jumped up because I've not been to the Edinburgh Bridge before. So while they were all rehearsing, I started writing, just to see how that went. And I wrote a play, and I showed it to a boy in my year at university who was highly regarded and is a theatre director now.
Right.
And he read it and started giving it much more praise than it deserved. And because he was so highly regarded, I just got this reputation as a writer. Next time they did things with, they did the next time, like, my drama society
Yeah.
peers and everything were doing things, I was asked to write for it.
And
And
how did
from
that
writing,
feel? How did that feel?
I think, like, it didn't occur to me that I wrote any better than anybody else. So I think I was saying, oh yeah, well, anyone can write, and people are like, yeah, but not anyone can write like you. And then I kind of started to believe that, just because this was something that came a bit more easily to me didn't mean that it was something that came easily to everyone. So maybe
Yeah.
this was just something that I had a talent for. And because I was writing, I got to be in stuff as well.
And was that how you decided to do your MA in playwriting then?
Basically, I had a careers interview because I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do when I graduated. So I went to the careers advisor. I said, look, I don't think I can be an actor. I'm visually impaired. And the careers advisor said, well, there are visually impaired actors. And, have you heard of Grey Eye?
Yeah.
So I googled them, and I discovered that one of the lecturers at my university used to be their creative director. So she wasn't there anymore, but she'd gone to Royal Holloway, but her wife was there,
Right.
so I went to see her. And yeah the and yeah she talked to me about MAs in research, and I think she was quite keen for me to go down the academic route, having taught me for 3 years.
Right.
That wasn't something I was massively keen to do at the age of 22. I don't know if I'd feel differently about it now. And I spoke to another lecturer, and he said, well, why don't you do playwriting? And then, you can still do an MA, but you're doing something that's a bit more hands-on in the industry. So I googled MAs in playwriting, and then Royal Holloway came up again. I was like, oh, okay, so I could go to the uni where Colette is, and but I could also do playwriting. So I did that, and I think it was quite I'd never left home before, and I wrote the application. I can't remember even if I told my parents I was doing it. I took a year out. I took 2 years out eventually because they postponed the course. So and I sent off an application, and I got a letter in the post offering me an unconditional place. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to hide that and think about it later. And like, it would get prospectuses. We're like, we really hope you'll come here. And I just thought, I haven't applied anywhere else, so you don't have to win me over. But yeah, we went down for an open day, and it was a campus uni, which I think assuaged my parents' fears a little bit, because like it was a bit more difficult to get lost, and it wasn't actually in London, it was in Surrey, so I didn't have the fear of the busy London life. So yeah,
We do frozen, Amy. Awesome. So, would you be able to kind of talk a little bit about your writing process? And does it change?
oh gosh, that's a question.
I know.
The
Does it change
literally
depend?
everything I've written, I've followed a different process.
Right.
I don't really know what, I don't really have a blueprint for what I do. I think it, for me, it's just connecting to what I want to write and working out the best way to do that is part of my process.
Right.
For like trying to think of work that we're going to be referring to. So yeah, for Libby's Eyes, I kind of started with the idea that I wanted to write something sci-fi and that I wanted a blind central character. So that's where that came from. It ended up being a parody of the PIP process because I don't know, that occurred to me
That's
right at the
really
very
interesting.
end. And for me, for now, it seems like the obvious thing to do, but like it almost didn't really occur to me until the very end. to do that. Like my first draw, I mean, some things that my play that my processes have had in common. Like quite often my first draft of a full length play is about 20 to 30 pages
Right.
because I've just put all the ideas down and I haven't really fleshed them out. Yeah, that's
Do you think
yeah.
having these different ways in gives you a bit more kind of creative freedom and you're not restricted by
It's not necessarily
anything?
that as much as, you know, I think like it's all very well having a writing process and being like, oh, this is what I like to do, and I'm on this bit now, and I'm on this
Yeah.
bit now. I think like for me, I'm very focused on the end result, and I know that every play is different, therefore every process to getting to it is going to be
Yeah.
different. And yeah, there are things that my processes have in common. Like the short first draft and also tons of research is, unless I'm writing something autobiographical, yeah, I will, you know, I do lots of reading and I read to the point where I feel like I understand enough to write about it, and that's intuitive. It's not, I don't think, right, I'm going to read 10 books. I read until I feel like I'm confident enough to write. And quite often, especially if you're reading on Kindle or whatever, it'll say, oh, you've read this, why don't you read this next? And, you know, so you kind of go down a rabbit hole a bit with that. Also, you know, and I just feel like for me, plays need to do something, they need to serve something politically. So, you know, it's understanding where I'm fitting into that and what I'm doing, and I think, you know, that's. You know, you can't have the same process for something like that.
No, that makes sense. And kind of breaking into the industry after graduating, what were the challenges of that for you?
The industry in general, or by being a disabled artist in particular?
Kind of both, like, because there are difficulties for young artists generally, but then for people like us,
Yeah, I mean, I
the
feel like one of the biggest difficulties was everyone else graduated my MA and wanted to work in the industry and came from the UK, moved to London straight after they graduated, whereas that option wasn't really available to me because the work they were doing, like temp work or call centre work, wasn't really something that was accessible to me. So what I had to move back to Bristol and live with my parents. I get on great with my parents. But, you know, it was just in Bristol, there wasn't as much available for people at my career stage. And I got a front of house job. And, you know, one of the things I feel like, you know, underemployment was rife when I graduated. And, you know, I'm kind of in that disability bracket where I can do jobs that require manual labour, but I'm not very good at them. So I will, you know, like I, you know, I've been an usher since I moved to London, and I was great at it because, you know, I found my own way to do it. But it's constantly finding different ways of doing things that come easily to non-disabled people, and that isn't even what you ultimately want to do. It's just what you're doing to aid what you want to do, and the fact that you have to put that much effort into that is quite distracting, like when you're trying to do other work as well. And
And it means you can't put that energy back into your playwriting.
yeah, sometimes, I mean, I have very high energy levels, so you know, I wasn't, but people didn't understand why I would get so upset when I couldn't get things right in my front of house assistant job. But you know, that's always what I've been like to a certain degree. But you know, it was just, you know, I just wanted to crack it so that I could get on with my writing. And you know, but also I feel like, you know, and obviously this isn't a slight on any individuals, but sometimes, like, you know, you can get talked down to if there are basic things that you have difficulty with, and then people are very surprised when there are complicated things that you don't have difficulty
Goodness,
with.
yeah. I've been
You know, and it
there.
can erode your self-esteem just as a person.
And I don't know if you get this, but for me, Then there's the thing of thinking that you've constantly got to prove yourself in some way.
Yeah, I think that's a thing, but also it's, you know, and I think possibly there's a gendered thing here as well. Like, you don't want to make a fuss, and you don't want, and you know, so how are you cashing up your till so slowly? So I don't want to be like, well, it's because I can't see the coins. You know, because you think, well, there's no solution to that.
Yeah.
And you've just learned to deal with things. You're just like, no, it's all right. I'll learn to deal with it. I'll learn to deal with it. It's like knowing. And then I saw a male staff member who had this, who also identified as dyspraxic, and he had somebody to help him cash up his till because he'd said it's because I'm dyspraxic and I find difficulty with it. Whereas it's like, well, I didn't say that because I thought I'd just have to get on with it.
That's really interesting. But you were part of so how did you first hear about Grey Eye and get involved with Grey Eye?
I started getting involved with them while I was doing my MA, and it was something that I was quite determined to do when I got to London because I couldn't see myself cracking that journey at any, you know, at a better time to crack that journey. And the lecturer that used to be their creative director got the literary associate at the time, Carissa, to get in touch with me, and she sure showed me how to get there, and off I went, and I was having literary meetings with her, and she was my first real contact in the industry. I didn't really know how to manage those relationships, so I was just sending her everything I ever wrote and telling her about everything I've ever seen. And she seemed to like that. She seemed to be replying. She said, oh, I've got you down to come to a rehearsal observation and things like that. So, you know, it was kind of my first process of forging an industry relationship. But it took me years to learn how to do that, right, to the standard I can do it now.
And how did the kind of right to play scheme come about?
The inaugural year of right to play was in 2013-14 to ended up being 2015 because it was, you know, things kept getting moved around and stuff. But my MA finished in 2012. So I did the Royal Court National Writers Group because Carissa left Grey Eye, I went to the Royal Court.
Right.
And she recommended me for the National Writers Group, which I did in 2013. And from there, the administrator was Chloe, who ended up going to Grey Eye. So that's how the industry worked, which, you know, fair enough. They've got small, you know, people with those expertise will move around in those kinds of circles. Then they advertised Right to Play, and I thought it looked good, but I didn't know if it was something that I wanted to do straight after doing an MA.
Yeah.
Then Amit, the associate director, emailed me and said, why haven't you applied for this? So I thought, oh, okay, I will apply. I finished my application at 6 a.m. on the day of the deadline. The deadline was 9 a.m.
Goodness.
Sent that off. And I got an interview, and I met the partner organisations, which were the Royal Court, who I already knew, and then there was also Soho Theatre and the National Theatre Studio, who were the other partner organisations. And it was I met them, and they offered me a place. And I didn't realise it was going to be such a big thing. I didn't realise there were going to be so many photos and pictures on the website. Like, that was massively overwhelming. But I now appreciate that that is part and parcel of being a playwright.
And what did you write for the Right to Play?
Well, that's quite interesting because, I can't remember what all of my Right to Play peers wrote about. But I know the ones I worked closely with, we didn't write about disability.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, I'd only written about disability once, and that was in my Royal Court play. And I'd written a version, a Sense and Sensibility-based play about being visually impaired, which I'm hoping to develop for radio.
Cool.
But, I wanted to write about Generation Y and, like, you know, and my generation being a lost generation and full of underemployment. Now that affects different people in different ways. And yeah, so I set out to write that. And like 3 drafts in, we were going to share some of it. And yeah, there was the main character in it was called Phoebe, and her experience was probably the nearest to mine. Like, I had Joanna, who was in retail and wanting to make a career in it. I had James, who was wanted to be a teacher, and I had Phoebe, who was an intellectual and didn't really know what she wanted to do. And yeah, and they all end up equally screwed, spoiler alert. Yeah, and the person reading Phoebe was one Amy Trigg, who recently won the Women's Prize and did her own monologue and is just generally amazing in every way. And Amit said, "Do you want to incorporate the fact that Amy is a wheelchair user into the play?" And I said, "Yeah," because I wanted people to not cover up the fact that they were disabled. So, we did incorporate it, and it's like, "Oh, I'll be rubbish at bar work." I said, "Yeah, well, you couldn't work do bar work, could you? You're a wheelchair user." And I thought, "I've written a disabled character without even meaning to."
How
And
did
it was
that?
only by seeing somebody with a visible disability or visible impairment playing that role that I realized I was writing about my own invisible impairment. And from that, yeah, sorry, go on.
Do you think disabled writers are pushed too much into, there's an expectation that we're going to write about disability?
There wasn't a right to play because I think, they got that. But I feel like, you can deliberate. I think disabled writers sometimes put that pressure on themselves as well. Like, I think organizations that aren't disabled led, possibly do put more of an expectation on it. I feel like sometimes disabled writers will put that pressure on themselves to either deliberately write a disability play or deliberately not write a disability play. And when actually the answer is somewhere in between. Like, the fact that I'm a disabled person is my lived experience. So, that is going to be reflected in what I write about. And that doesn't mean I have to write about disability all the time, but it does mean that being disabled informs my writing.
An element of that lived experience will inform whatever you write about, where.
Absolutely. That's what I've just said to you, being underemployed as a disabled person is completely different to being underemployed as a non-disabled person.
And sorry, can you refer back to my question? And following that, you gained a place on the Soho Theatre Writers' Lab. How did the two experiences compare?
Well, I actually did my placement at Soho Theatre. The placement was part of Right to Play. And I absolutely loved Soho Theatre. It's like the Edinburgh Fringe all year round. I just love how there's like plays everywhere and different types of shows and a bit of this and a bit. I love how you can like go there at 6 o'clock, come out at 9, and you'll have seen 3 things. It's just like, it's one of my favourite places to be. Yeah, and I had real fun on it, but I sat with the Writers' Lab people and I wrote some script reports because that was something I was into, and Jules was really great at sorting that out for me. So yeah, then my friend Ross Willis got onto Soho Writers' Lab himself, but he hadn't done an MA or anything like that. He's just a natural genius. But he got on to Soho Theatre Writers' Lab, I was in a bit of a writing slump by 2016 because I was still in Bristol and I was still thinking, right, what am I even doing with this? So they lifted the age cap on Writers' Lab because it used to be just up to 25, and I was 27 when I finished Right to Play. When they lifted the age cap, I thought I'd have a go at applying, and I got a place. And it was all people over 25, which was really refreshing to see in a new writers group. And yeah, it was a really great experience, actually. And because I think I'd sat on my writing for so long, like I kind of had the determination to just take more risks. And yeah, and I think, I thought, right, I'm gonna write a blind play this time, and I don't care if I don't get every detail right. I'm just gonna write a play where the central character is blind, and I'm gonna write about a robot and explore the themes of defectiveness and fixing people.
So was this Libby's eyes?
Yeah.
So what was the process of the idea and writing the play?
Well, we started off by writing a monologue for the central character, and I wrote a monologue for Libby. And yeah, one of my buddy groups made a very astute observation. So, well, I've never seen a lead character that's blind, and now I think, why haven't I? And I was like, great, that's exactly what I'm going for. Then I thought, okay, how is the robot going to fit into this? And I had all this really, like, I call the robot Cortana because that's what I had on my computer at the time. And so there was a lot of writing about robotics and trying to work out how that fitted in from a sci-fi perspective. I got it to three drafts. It reached the top 100 of the VBA, which I was pleasantly surprised about because it still kind of wasn't in a very coherent structure. But I think, my dramaturg was Charlotte Bennett, and she was fab. She, like, it had all the elements in it that I wanted it to have. But then my friend Georgie, who's a visually impaired comedian, I told her about the idea because she was doing comedy lab the same time I was doing writer's lab, and she said, "Oh, put this on, I want to be in it." So we saw that the Bunker Theatre were advertising for the Breaking Out Festival. So we pitched to that, and we got on. And one of the key questions they said in the interview was, "Why the bunker?" I was like, "Well, because it's wheelchair accessible and a fringe space, and this play is about disability, so it's one of the only places it can go on."
And what kind of a response did you get to it?
We got on, and and I think, like, having that breathing space made me realize what it was about. It was about the PIP process, and I was going to, I'm very political, and I've got a very satirical brain, especially when I'm angry. And I'd just been through the PIP process. I think because I was going through it when I was writing the first three drafts, the fact that I'd been through it when I wrote the other draft kind of gave me that distance that I needed. I wrote the version where they were dividing disabled people into functioning and non-functioning people, and I played with the audio description. So I made the audio, that was always my idea, that I wanted a sassy audio description. And so I made the audio description an embittered actor that wanted to be in the play and didn't want to be audio describing. The actor was Louise Kempton, who was amazing, and she was really funny. But she also then played a load of authority figures, and while she was playing the authority figures, other characters would do the audio description and bring their perspectives on it. I was like, there we go, I've finally got something theatrical. And it was a great experience to put that on in the Breaking Out Festival. That was it. I think people thought that was my first play when it was actually just my first play in London.
Is that just you think the London centricness of the industry?
I think, like, there's people that. But then, there's, I think every city has its own centricity to a certain degree, doesn't it? It's just
Yeah,
London, it's a lot
true.
easier because there's loads of places in London.
Can you talk a little about how you use integrated access in your work and what we mean by that?
Well, for me, I think like it's not apologizing for the way I process things. So, like, I think we're often told as writers to show, not tell, whereas I kind of need to be told because I can't see. So, like, I think it could have, sometimes it used to affect the way I wrote dialogue. Because, I would need things explained. I thought, well, let's just explicitly put the audio description in the play. And then you can still have people speaking as people speak, but also, like, you can have the stage directions read out. I think, like, integrated access is an interesting one because I think that's a creative process too. And, like, you can have the wrong access consultant the same way you can have the wrong director. It's all a creative process, but also the kind of creative access that I've done, obviously the audio description in Libby's Eyes, which I've already talked about. And I think it's, I think you kind of come from a direction of what you would need as an audience member, and then, incorporating it for other people as well. I think what integrated access means to me is, thinking about people that process things differently from you, which actually is everybody in the whole world, because no two people's experiences are the same. But, it's thinking outside the bounds of, well, most people can see this much, or most people can hear this much. And it's like,
That's
actually,
true.
what about people that have no vision or no hearing? Like, what experience are they going to get? And like, audio description isn't about saying absolutely everything that's on the stage. It's about giving people that can't see what's happening a theatrical experience, the way people, the same as people who can see what's happening. I think that, that's, and I think as long as you know that, then it's, then it's like, that's kind of a good direction to go in. Though I do get often, oh, your writing would be suited to radio. It's like, well, that's not what the play is. Like, it's, there's, I think there are lots of plays that can be adapted for radio, absolutely. But, there's, radio is a medium in its own right, and just because something is audio described doesn't
Doesn't
mean
mean
it's a
it's
radio
really,
play.
that's really interesting though. And the piece you wrote for Theatre College Kitten Up last summer, Normal Day, can you talk a little bit about the piece?
I mean, that was one that started off as one page and then grew. I mean, I was basically given a brief that I spent a lot of time deciphering, that it was for two actors and that the actors were going to change around, and that the
The
object, and that there had to
plot,
be an
yeah.
object in it. And I
I
thought,
found that really difficult, kind of the plot and giving it
well, the thing is, I've
significance.
worked in casting, and I know that, casting has a huge impact on like what a play is or what any piece is. So I thought, if I'm going to write something where the actors are changing, then I need to write something malleable. So I deliberately wrote something absurdist that could be played by any two people. And I incorporated the object into it that way. I found that much more freeing than like trying to write a story with two defined characters in and thinking about two different actors that could do that. But like, and I'm sure two different actors could do that, but when I'm always involved in my work when I can be, and I try and, I'm always rewriting to suit the actor I've got. So, like a process where more than one person is going to be playing it, and that's part of it.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, the thing that would suit that is if I just wrote something that's
Mm.
absurdist. But I also kind of thought, you have to put feeling into things, even absurdist things. I was like, well, if I
Yeah.
write something that's absurdist and it's about, writing out of the pandemic for the first time, then I'm sure people will relate to that.
And did you manage to get up to the theatre club to see it?
I did, yeah. I went on a Monday night actually, and then I watched the play on the Tuesday.
And how did you, what were your thoughts in terms of how
It was really
it
fun, and actually there was it was a different act set of actors in the dress which I watched,
Yeah.
and then the show in the evening. It was just it was a really tight and great process. Obviously, all the actors were fantastic, and it was clearly something that everyone was just really happy to be a part of, which was a lot of things straight out of the pandemic. And I really appreciated the audience and how like receptive they were to everything, because they were just happy to be back at the theatre.
It was a really joyful kind of, and everyone kind of working together, and it was lovely to be back in the theatre. I'm glad you felt the same way. Hey, so your piece, Tinted, was a disabled-led response to the Me Too movement. Why did you feel that it was important for you to write that piece?
Well, I think basically Theatre 503 did a call out to a limited number of people to ask for pitches for a short play responding to the Me Too hashtag when it first started kicking off. So the evening was called "The Words Are Coming Now," and I thought, okay, what perspective do I have on this that nobody else does? So I got my disabled perspective out, to put it cynically. I wanted to I had three characters originally, but then the characters, like, I was clearly more interested in the visually impaired character than either of the other two. So I wrote a 10-minute monologue, and the director was Eileen Conant, who is lovely and runs a company called Theatre Timoir, and she really liked it. And we were looking everywhere for a visually impaired performer, because it was really important to me that a visually impaired performer did it. And we found Sarah Caltieri at the last minute, and she was great. She really embodied it. So then Eileen said, "Would you be interested in writing a full-length version of this?" Around the same time that Maria Ashodi from Extant was sending an email out saying, "Does anyone have any ideas of what we could do for the Bloomsbury Festival?" And I said, well, because Maria came to see the original piece, I said to her, well, could I maybe extend this? And she said, yeah, that sounds great. Extant commissioned me to write the full version, which I retitled Tinted, and we did it at the Bloomsbury Festival in 2018.
And what were the challenges of taking a 10-minute short and turning it into a full-length play?
Well, I think first of all, I thought that if I was going to make it full length, I needed to make more events happen. But Eileen said that, I tried to make it into a 5-year relationship, and she said, oh, it just doesn't read like a 5-year relationship. And I was like, got me, I haven't had a 5-year relationship. So I kind of took it back. So I kind of just did the same events, but padded it out more and made the message a little bit bigger. And rather than it being about, rather than the 10-minute piece, which was just, consent means a different thing to me when I can't see. The full length piece was more disabled people don't get bodily autonomy the same way non-disabled people do, and it just mined it a little bit deeper.
And were you more satisfied as a writer with the full length
Oh yeah,
version?
definitely. I mean, it's since been mounted in a different production at the Vault. We did it at the Vault Festival in 2020, which I was one of the last people to have a show on at that festival before it was cancelled. So, and that was with a director, Elska Waite, who is fab, and has worked with Access All Areas, and performer Charlotte Ayres, who I met at the Bunker, because it was a promenade piece and they gave her to me as an Access worker, and chatting to her I found out she was visually impaired as well. So it was a literal case of the blind leading the blind. When Sarah discovered she couldn't do it, so we got some people to self-tape, when I found out that Charlotte was visually impaired, I said, "Oh, well, do you want to self-tape for this script?" And she did, and she was the one they went with.
Fantastic.
She was fab.
I'm going to move on slightly. I just kind of want to talk before we finish about what more do you think what we would call maybe mainstream companies need to do to work with deaf and disabled artists, and how can we as disabled artists challenge the barriers to access that exist? I know that's a massive question.
And I think, like, the thing with the arts is that it exists in the backdrop of capitalism. And
yeah.
Capitalism doesn't like disabled people. I think that, you know, there's sometimes a paradox in arts because it exists in capitalism, it doesn't immediately make money. Therefore, the resources it gets are often very limited. But the limitation of resources can have the biggest impact on the people that need them most.
Definitely.
And I think it's juggling that paradox and accepting that you're going to mess up and not being defensive when you do, and appreciating that when you've met one disabled artist, you've met one disabled artist. Like, no two people are going to have the same needs, and it's just a case of, you know, sometimes it's a case of asking people what they need. And not being defensive or panicking if you don't immediately have the answer. I think we kind of still need to be told that they will accommodate access requirements and that, they will reach out to people. I did an angry tweet because that's what I do. But, like, you know, if I see opportunities that call out for underrepresented voices and then the application form isn't screen reader accessible, it's just stuff like that. So what do you even think underrepresented means? Is it just a word to you?
Sometimes I feel that we are the minority that sometimes is not included in those call-outs. I don't know whether you feel the same.
Sometimes they will specifically write disabled in the call-out and, like, not have any way of it being screen reader accessible, not having any way of applying in BSL, if that's what you want to do. I don't think we're necessarily... I think we're less of a forgotten minority.
Right.
I think people are starting to include us more in things, and that's largely thanks to Jack Thorne. I think we owe a lot of that to him.
Incredible McTaggart lecture. Oh, he would be a dream guest for this podcast.
Well, I'm sure we can get him on.
But yeah, I guess I think we need allies as well. We need people
definitely.
To come with
and,
us.
I think disability allyship can, it's really easy for people that are already friends with disabled people and that, who take a vested interest in disability access. But also, I think there's, a lot of allies get very angry on disabled people's behalf, which is very nice to see, but also it's like, I don't have the energy to be that angry all the time.
No.
And so in some ways it's nice that you do it for me, but also, it also goes to show that you don't live with it all the time.
Exactly. Yeah, I think we should definitely take the lead on advocating for ourselves, and we need to be listened to.
Oh yeah, completely. And I've got some, I've got some lovely friends and allies, and a lot of them have worked with me as access workers. And and I feel like everyone's got their own method of allyship, just the same way everyone's got their own method of political activism. And and everyone's on a journey. There's no set way to be a good ally.
No, absolutely, I agree with you. My last question before I let you go and enjoy the rest of your Saturday is, what advice would you give to someone who is just starting out in the industry?
What generally?
Yeah, kind of
What do
if
they want to do?
well, if you kind of looked at yourself when you were starting out, what would you, maybe this is a better way of framing it. What would you say to a younger version of yourself?
I'd say there's dickheads everywhere. Don't let them grind you down. Yeah, I would say as well, I would say that you've got needs and that's okay. And your experiences are valid. What you have to say is valid. And don't feel like you have to fit into anything that you don't. Just the more confidently you can be yourself, the further you'll go.
Thank you, Amy. It's fantastic. It's been lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for your
Thank you.
time. That's just about it for this episode of In Lockdown With. Thank you to Amy, Beth, and Ellen for joining me. I will see you on the next episode of In Lockdown With, where my guest will be the actor Richard Milam. But until then, it's bye from me, bye from Amy. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of In Lockdown With. The podcast is written, produced, and curated by me, Kieran Fitzgerald. Thank you to all my guests for taking the time to appear on the show. If you enjoyed this episode of In Lockdown With, please consider liking or subscribing on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And I'll see you next time for another interview.